This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Embracing Doom in Page Turners.
The Curopira.
And Tranche 1 of my Bay Area book haul. Robin, I just saw a tuxedo cat change into a red cape, then leap off the town hall clock tower. Have I been sniffing too much catnip?
You just saw a super kitty, Ken. We're not in River City anymore. Welcome to Meowtropolis, the brand new superhero setting for the Magical Kitties Save the Day RPG.
Super kitties? I thought magical was already pretty impressive. You're telling me these cats have secret identities now, too?
Precisely. In Meowtropolis, your kitty is a caped crusader, protecting the bustling city from diabolical supervillains. We're talking secret hideouts, origin stories, and power quirks that add the earth-shattering kaboom to your series.
Sounds like the stakes just got a whole lot higher. And the best part... The Meowtropolis Kickstarter is live right now.
We've got the Meowtropolis Hometown Book, the Trouble in River City Adventure Collection, and even a new solo puzzle book called Mice's Gambit.
This is obviously the one I've been waiting for, but Kickstarter campaigns don't last forever. We'd better pounce on those rewards before the clock runs out.
Head to atlas-games.com/backmeow. To get your super kitty supplements before they're gone. That's atlas-games.com/backmeow.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. But today in the gaming hut once more, we find ourselves... in Mom's office, or possibly the church basement. We're in the gaming hut that is lined with improving literature, because once more, the game to be hutted is Page Turners, the one-on-one game of drama, available now from Pelgrane Press, designed by you, Robin D. Laws, my beloved cross-border podcast partner. And since you're the designer, it's handy that you're here to talk about embracing your character's downfall, because many, many dramas, and I don't think I'm telling anyone spoilers, and badly for the main character. One only has to think of perhaps Anna Karenina or Hamlet to say, ugh, I don't like drama. That's gross. I'd rather do adventure.
Well, we're not saying we don't like drama. It's the whole point of the game. But the thing that happens in Page Turners is that you can select ahead of time, in consultation with the GM, the outcome of the scenario. And so there may be some that only lead to one possible outcome, but in others you get to pick what it is. And the three possible outcomes are union, that is the happy ending, the comedy, the marriage at the end, whatever it is.
Aristotelian comedy, yes.
Then there's ambiguous, in which is more like, you know, contemporary literary fiction, in that there's neither necessarily a defeat or a victory. There's not a comedy or tragedy. There is a life continuing to go on as life goes on, and we're not necessarily sure all the time how we feel about that. And then finally, there's doom, which, of course, is the one we're talking about. This put me in mind of Kurt Vonnegut's famous quote, which he paraphrased in different ways at different times, usually with a list of titles in the middle of the sentence. But he says, all great literature is about what a bummer it is to be a human being. And
take that, Huckleberry Finn. Not great literature, according to Vonnegut.
Huckleberry Finn is definitely a dark view of America that is about what a bummer it is to be a human being.
But it's a pretty great thing to be Huck Finn, though.
Yeah, but this is a whole other hut where we can get into the what we think American literature is about. And when we actually look at all the works of American literature, how they are doom, 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 doom. American lit is the counterforce to American self-love and progress and all of those things that we associate with my neighbors to the South. And often when you think of American literature, you think of the movie versions, not of the written text. So if we're looking for something that, like, you know, The Great Gatsby or The Good Soldier or Moby Dick or this long list of things that explore the dark side of humanity or ultimately tragedies. The interesting thing that comes up in page turners, and this is a feature, not a bug, it's the point of the thing, is your inherent conflict between identifying with your protagonist and thinking of them as an extension of you, and typically in most other games, wanting them to succeed and solve problems, and then entering a situation where you are embracing, you're attempting to move your character toward an unhappy ending, toward something that ends the narrative on a note of a finality that that just ain't great. That's like great literature. And so the issue then becomes, how do you actually keep that going over the course of an intense 2 to 3 hour page turners session in a way that is satisfying, that makes that essential sort of contradiction between what you want to happen for the character as the author versus what you want to have happen to the character as the audience member and surrogate and protector. How do you actually do that? Because once the rubber hits the road, even if you think you're heading for a dark ending, often the temptation is to pull back and be protective and look out for them, which is fine if you decide ahead of time that it might be ambiguous or it might be doom, or it is weird to have both doom and union as possible results, but you can do that. But the chances are what you're going to start doing as a player is you're going to start moving toward union if that's an option, because that has your character winning, who you care about and identify with and has sort of become part of you. So the question I want to look at now is techniques for doing the thing you thought you wanted to do at the beginning and really making that happen. And I think the first tip, I guess, would be maybe this is something that you want to do for streaming for an audience, because that helps you to stay more on the author side of things and think about how the people watching the stream are going to feel if you're heading tragic, 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 and then whoops, I got out of it, everything's fine. That's going to be an unsatisfying narrative outcome.
You get like the William Davenant ending to Lear, where Cordelia faked her death, everything's happy, yay!
Yeah, yes, there's whole periods of the English stage where they rewrote all of the unhappy endings, and that's part of the dynamic as well, is that we are programmed somehow to identify with characters, even with anti-heroes, even with tragic heroes, and therefore we want to root for them. And at different times, it's people, you know, they rewrote Romeo and Juliet to, oh no, that was just a knockout drug, they're all fine, and now the yep. Capulets and the Montagues see the errors of the way and they all sing a song at the end and there's a marriage and there's union, right? But so Ken, how why don't you envision a story that has a tragic ending, and we'll think up what the protagonist would be if you're heading your protagonist toward doom.
Well, I mean, we could go with the one that I mentioned at the beginning, Anna Karenina, where basically she's pursuing selfish love against the wishes of society and against the wishes of family and against the wishes of everyone who's smarter than her in the novel. And even though she's, you know, trying to keep aiming for union, everything keeps undercutting her and turning it to doom. And I think that's the sort of most challenging version of that. Should we go with the most challenging version, the Anna Karenina, where the character keeps trying to head for union? Or should we go more Hamlet, where the character has kind of half embraced his doom from the jump and is just determined to see it through Seneca style? Which model do you think? I mean, I think Hamlet's easier to play than Anna Karenina, certainly, if you were picking.
Right, because that gets us into a whole other definitional segment, which is the difference between melodrama and drama, mm-hmm. where melodrama, and again, like railroading in RPGs, has 7 different meanings. But the core useful meaning is a melodrama is a story in which things are happening to the suffering character. And a drama is a thing where the character's personal impulses and contradictions lead them toward a tragic outcome. So let's go with a tragedy. And this is useful because it comes to my next bit of advice, which is think of yourself as committing the act that precipitates your downfall, whether it's, you know, literally having a tragic flaw that you act upon, or a personality trait that you're continually going back to, for example, you know, the Harvey Keitel character in Bad Lieutenant or any of those sort of spiral out of control narratives. And you have, and this is where we get to the dramatic pulls that your character has, where you have probably a good version of that and a negative version of that. And so Hamlet's dramatic pulls are not entirely clear cut in that sense of having one that's positive and one that's negative, in that he's torn between action and contemplation. And right. He is kind of screwed because both of those things lead to doom, right? They're both
He's just in Denmark. Things are messed up there, yeah. As I believe
but
Shakespeare says.
But they're not happening just to him. He's doing things, or he's torturing himself for not doing things.
Right.
But either way, that always leads him toward his doom. And the thing that he essentially does that triggers his doom is he is contemplating killing a king, even though this king needs killing, deserves it, is not a rightful king. But still, you know, a ghost and a prince meet and everyone ends in mincemeat, as the song goes. Mm-hmm. So your trick there is playing a character like Hamlet who has, in a situation where the union is off the menu, you got to pick your doom. And so that may be one way of looking at it, is that the suspense is not whether you are doomed, but what doom you pick and how honorably you go down.
Right.
Whether you go down as an admirable but flawed person who's destroyed by their flaws or by their incapacity to deal with the circumstances or not. Or the other way is that you can look at it as more as, you know, like the Bad Lieutenant, where you have crossed a line, the way Macbeth has crossed a line, if we want to stay in Shakespeare territory. And once that line gets crossed, you know that this character is going to have to pay. And so in that, you are creating a narrative where you want to see the character fall down in as epic a manner as possible.
Yeah. And you're driving it like a rental, as they say.
Exactly. So in the Hamlet model, you know you're probably doomed, but your goal is to take other people with you.
Right.
And in the Macbeth model, you're the anti-hero. You've done the bad thing because your dramatic pulls between loyalty and ambition. You did a big, big ambition thing right at the beginning, and now you can't go back to loyalty. You can only keep building your ambition, and other people have ambitions, and they're coming after you. And then the final technique is just to retain the distance from your identification with the character to think of where does the story need to go in order to be satisfying, even though the GM is sometimes throwing things at you that pull you also in the direction of a satisfying ending, but maybe not the one you're thinking of, or maybe trying to keep the narrative going by, you know, throwing you, your character, life preservers long enough to get to the end of the story. So instead of having your immediate downfall after you kill King Duncan, then you get a success, you get something happens to help you, and you manage to sort of stay afloat for a little while longer, and you consolidate your power, but then things start to go wrong again. So between thinking of the structure of a story in which you've crossed a line and then have to pay the price for that, and stepping back from that character, I think are the key techniques. And the thing to do is always remember, if things seem to go too well for you, often it's the GM's job in page turners, as well as in multiplayer drama system, to make things more difficult. But you can also think of ways to make things more difficult because it's more fun to play that way. So call a scene that's the worst possible interaction to have right now and to dig into the fun of playing a character who shows what a bummer it is to be a human being.
Yeah, given the number of people who have aimed perfectly normal role-playing parties into disaster by insisting they were just playing their character, surely this cannot be a giant reach to say, I'm just playing my character, and he's a poisonous alcoholic who drives everyone who cares for him away. So, great, let's get into it. There used to be talk of sort of author stance, where you are helping write the story with your character, and actor stance, where you're playing the guy playing your character, not necessarily playing your character. And I think, I'm not saying take either of those stances, but maybe as you're playing your character, think a bit about the guy who's playing them in the movie or the stage play of this story, and think a little bit about, you know, the script that you read, and now you're improvising, but you know that, you know, the end is coming and there's going to have to be a certain number of corpses on stage at the end for the story to work. And I think when you're talking about, you know, think about doing it as streaming so that you're kept honest by the notion of an audience. You could also imagine a fictional audience, even if you're not streaming, if it is just you and your friend or you and your spouse playing this game. You know, think about the imaginary audience and sort of aim towards that. And if that means you're playing maybe a little bigger than you would normally, that's probably great. That's probably a good thing for drama.
Yes, because this is definitely role playing on hard setting. You're fighting against an instinct that you have, which I think the whole point of that is that it's instructive and different and fresh and something that you haven't been through before. It's not for everybody. Some people are listening. It's going, I only want to win. Well, then you play one of the lighter ones. You play the screwball comedy or the Shakespearean comedy, or you drive your character toward a victory or a redemption. And those are all, you know, perfectly fine. That's, doom is not the only outcome in page turners. So once you've done that, you can certainly pat yourself on the back for having done something difficult and done it well. And maybe that will give you insights into playing other characters where their doom is not foretold.
And while you pat yourself on the back, keep reaching around to the door of the gaming hut, because we need to leave it to go see what's going on in this exciting advertisement and perhaps in another hut just past that.
Ballad Hunters, the gumshoe game of folk songs going supernaturally wrong on the gritty side of the Regency era, is on Kickstarter until April 16th.
Britain, 1813.
Across the island, the folk ballads of the common people are coming to life.
The dead walk, dragons rise, lovers betray one another, authorities condemn innocents to die. Whatever happens in the song happens in real life.
In Ballad Hunters, you play amateur folklorists working as agents of the crown.
It's up to you, armed with a little ballad magic, to decipher the clues in each song and keep people alive long enough to change the ending.
Designed by Tristan Zimmerman, whose spin on Gumshoe was so brilliant and radical, we had to create a new line for it.
You arrive knowing something is wrong.
You hear someone sing the song.
Reality bends to its structure.
You find textual interpretations, then act on them.
The GM responds in the spirit of yes and.
The ending is never guaranteed.
Singing at the table is optional, but encouraged.
Group singing is a joy, and Ballad Hunters is a perfect excuse to sing a song with your friends.
Now on Kickstarter from Pelgrane Press.
Sing it, Ken!
Now on Kickstarter from Pelgrane Press. The rustle in the underbrush, the shape against the moonlight, the stat block just off your peripheral vision welcome us into that most terrifying of huts. Well, among the most terrifying of huts. We got a lot of terrifying huts now that I look around. But in this one, there be monsters, because this is the Monster Hut. And in today's Monster Hut, that forest is the Brazilian rainforest, because our monster is the Brazilian monster, the Curupira. And Robin, you have selected the Curupira out of zillions of other monsters. So what gives? What's with the Curupira, man?
So I think the Curupira is fascinating, not just because we can easily envision him as either the straight-up monster, the antagonist in a horror game, or the sort of lovable or sympathetic monster that's such a powerful image, but also that he undergoes an entire cyclical development from, let's just start with a spoiler, from god to demon to monster to rather recently doing a face turn and becoming a hero monster again. So he's really covers the bases. There's lots of different versions of the Curupira, different names, and you know, there's a lot of cultures in the Brazilian rainforest, and I think even within cultures in different locales there are different stories that attach to this being. And I think he's mostly mythical. I think people don't cite him as a cryptid, which is why this is in the Monster Hut, but not in the Elliptony Hut. But Ken, you've done a little research on his origin story, and he starts out with a somewhat longer name.
Yeah. In Tupi, he is the Kuru Pira, which means rough or blistered skin. And every so often, he is confused with the Kapora, another Tupi name meaning forest dweller. Also, the Kaipora is another way to spell it. They've all got a zillion different ways to spell it. We're not going to get into that. But the Brazilians themselves seem to have got them jumbled up after about 1800. The Kaipora probably postdates the Curupira because the Jesuits who were writing down all the legends of the natives that they encountered don't mention him. He only shows up well after Christianity has visited the land and Brazil is beginning to be knitted together by the Portuguese colonizers. So the Kapora is maybe a downgrade or a version or a cousin of the Curupira. So except no substitutes, except I guess you kind of have to accept substitutes.
Right. Well, that's one of the great things is that the mythology is still evolving and changing. It's a living set of folklore tropes. And most accounts basically kind of conflate the Curupira and the Kapora, but some of them have the Kapora as sort of a super friend, as an ally of the Curupira, who not only has a slightly different job to do, but has a different form as a dark, hairy giant who, like the Curupira, sometimes rides a peccary or I guess if in giant form. I don't know whether the peccary also gets giant. And yeah,
sometimes they ride a rabbit, which would be even more ridiculous. Curupira or Kapora riding a rabbit.
Or perhaps there's a giant rabbit, which would be scary. We know about rabbits. And in some of the tales, he is sort of a warner of wildlife who scares away the game and has them flee into the forest as human hunters approach, which seems like it sort of backwards evolved from an original possibility of this figure being a forest god or gods who you had to propitiate in order to have a good relationship with the forest, which, as we all know from pre-modern times, is a scary, dangerous place. And you need to bribe the forest, or in this case, its humanoid representatives in order to survive in it.
So the Curupira, as I say, does come back to Jesuit times. Our first mention of him is by a Jesuit named Jose de Anchieta, who mentions running into this forest demon in 1560, goes into villages, and he would see the villages full of whipped, mutilated, or blistered bodies. And the villagers would say, oh, the Curupira has been here, and he beat everybody up, and we have to bring feathers and hammers and things up into the hills and leave them for him as tribute so that he won't do that again. And that same legend shows up again in 1797 and also includes the voice of the Curupira heard in the village demanding sacrifices. So this seems to be a pretty long-standing motif of the Curupira. And when you combine the possibility of being named blistered bodies and this specific story, it makes me think this sounds an awful lot like a myth explaining smallpox. Smallpox, of course, would have come out of nowhere to the Brazilian natives. It came out of Columbus, in fact. And since there is some people that say the Curupira may have begun as a Carib legend, even though the first smallpox outbreak known in Brazil is 1563, so after the Curupira is mentioned, if it's a Carib legend, maybe it comes down from the Caribbean. And we certainly have similar beings in Venezuela and in Guyana, you know, so basically the area between the Caribbean and Brazil. So perhaps that's what the Curupira sort of starts as. But by 1584...
Right. And there could be just as easily an otherwise undocumented earlier outbreak, because if there's Westerners there, there's smallpox.
Right. Yeah, it could have come from over the mountains in Peru and gone into the jungle area, and they would have never known about it. So he's described as one of the names of the devil by another Jesuit, Father Cardim, in 1584, and the naturalist Margrave, who goes through Brazil in 1644, names him as one of the three devil names, Anhanga, Jurupari, and Curupari. So not quite Curupiru, but still, as I say, the name drifts all over the place. And Margrave specifically calls Curupari the nomen mentis, the spirit of thoughts, which means maybe the god of thoughts or the god of lies or the god of craftiness. It's not sure. Maybe a traveler god. If you're going through the forest, you need him to protect you. This is basically guesswork by a non-professional anthropologist. So take that for what it's worth.
And it's basically people trying to put this within the framework of Christian demonology. And so here we're seeing the drift from God to spirit to demon.
Yeah. And certainly by the 1640s, and Margrave being German and his partner being Dutch, they were not as concerned with keeping things Catholic. They understood that pagans had gods, and they weren't not necessarily concerned with the etiology of it, but they still didn't have a particularly sophisticated way of talking to people about it. And this is what we got. So the guess is, by modern anthropologists, that he began, as you say, as a forest or hunting god, maybe the god of knowing where the animals are. And he gets downgraded under Portuguese Catholicism to being a local demon. And then the sort of demon stories sort of, you know, boil up around him. So the description, by the time we start getting descriptions as opposed to scary names, is that he is a small being. He resembles a big-eared or possibly pointed-eared native Brazilian. He may have blue or green teeth. That's one of the ways you can tell that he is a spirit as opposed to a person. The Caipora had red hair, and that may have been the Brazilians hearing stories of orangutans and saying, oh, our jungle guy has red hair too. But anyway, the Caipora had red hair. And so modern Curupira is usually drawn with bright red hair like a troll doll. And so that's great fun. And the Caipora is also the guy who began riding that peccary, riding the wild pig. And now Curupiras sometimes ride pigs as well. So that's what we know about them. The best thing about them, Robin, is that they have backward feet. Their feet point backwards so that when you're tracking the Curupira, you're going the wrong direction. You're going away from the Curupira, and that's how he fools hunters. Also, he's super strong. He can throw a full-grown Portuguese guy around, and he smells bad enough to knock you out. If he's trying to do actual tricks on you, he can sing an enchanting song, or he can imitate voices, or he can send misleading thoughts. He can either start fights within a group of people, or he can just send misleading thoughts to get you going left when you meant to go right. And as the stories go, the Curupira gets adopted by the lumberjacks in Brazil, and they tell ghost stories and monster stories about him. And then, as you suggest, sort of the modern ecologically conscious monster stories are now about him punishing those who overlog the forest. And so that keys in nicely to the demon of lumberjacks that he was for another 200 years, give or take.
Right. And those mental powers that he has are great because they can explain why you get lost in the woods that you're supposed to know, or why you all start arguing, and all sorts of reasons why your logging expedition goes wrong. And you don't even need to see a Curupira to know that he's done that to you, because surely that must be it. It must be an external force. And as you say, you know, now he's become an aggro Lorax, which is great.
Yeah.
But he does have weaknesses, Ken. And so if we are in the jungle and are afraid that we are being misled by a Curupira, what do we do?
You make a wheel, or in a clearly Christian version of the story, a cross. You can make a cross, not a wheel. And I can just imagine all the natives saying, we're going to do a wheel cross. How about that? And then they just leave the cross out. But you make a wheel out of liana vines, and either it will avoid it, or you just throw it down in the ground and the Curupira has to stop and unravel it like a vampire with a bunch of seeds or rice. The other way to get a Curupira on your side is just give it tobacco or cachaça. It loves that.
Right. Give it offerings like back when it was a god.
Like back in 1560, it explained very clearly what it wants, and you just have to do that. Also, I imagine that's a great way of getting tribes of local Brazilians to like you, is bring them tobacco and cachaça. So I think there may be a little best practices conflation there. We have another backward foot tribe, the Mutayu, which is described by Father Cristobal de Tristan de Acuña, and he goes both up and down the Amazon, 1637 and 1639. And the Mutayu seem to live sort of on the eastern edge of the Curupira's range, but there are other backward feet demons of the forest, the Pocai, which are the Mucuxi people in Roraima, which is up in northern Brazil by Guiana, the Loroco. That's the Pariki people just south of Roraima. And then on the Peruvian-Brazil border, the Quechua have a kind of a half Curupira named the Chulachaki. He has only one backward foot. So I'm not sure what he accomplishes with that, but he can turn into animals.
There's also variations of the Kirapira where he has two right feet, and that's the tell.
And that'll mess you up. And there are other forest demons whose only thing that points backward is their toe, which I don't even know how that works, except it's probably pretty gross looking.
It's like one step worse than an ingrown toenail. It's a
full exactly ingrown toe. The whole reverse grown toe. And now the Dominican Republic has a monster named the Ciguapa, which again doesn't show up in any of the early writing, and so is almost certainly a post-contact European contamination. And she is just a straight up seductive siren woman, a Lilith or a Lamia. And she has backwards feet, like many, you know, Liliths or Lamias have scaled feet or bird feet. She has backwards feet. But now a male Ciguapa that lives in urban areas, especially in America or elsewhere like that, it's now Dominicans in the U.S. will talk about the backwards foot guy that was following them in the city, and they're sort of haunted by this Ciguapa. So maybe that's like a Kurapira, you know, has gone north and he's in the urban jungle instead of the proper jungle, and he's got to sort of work out what the new rules are, and the only people he can find to know who he is to pester are the Dominicans. But I assume, you know, any neighborhood will do at some point for the Kurapira.
Well, I imagine he would look for other people who aren't looking for what direction his feet are pointing in.
Exactly, yeah. And of course, there are plenty of backwards feet, quote-unquote, natives described going all the way back to Megasthenes, who puts the new loy in India, and Pliny renames them the Abaramon, which is their more famous name, and they have backwards feet and live in the Himalaya foothills. The Condorong have backwards feet, and the Kulikpariga and Kinkiriga, those live in Africa. The Condorong is for the Wolof of Senegal, and the Kulikpariga lives in Ghana. The Dagbani and Gurensi have him. And then there is undead with backwards feet, the Churel in India, who's a lady, and she's an ugly, hideous lady, not a sexy lady like the Ciguapa, but she's still got backwards feet and messes with you. And then there is an undead child called the Duen in Trinidad, and the Duenes have backwards feet, and that's not good either. So backwards feet seem to be kind of a tell, but I like the idea that there's Kurapiras in India, they're just called Abaramons, and Kurapiras in the jungles of West Africa, but they're just called Condorong or Kulikpariga. And frankly, Kulikpariga is not a million miles from Kurapira, in my opinion. I mean, linguists may disagree, but that's their prerogative.
Right. So the most obvious scenario is that you have agreed to take some people into the jungle, and then you find out that they're there to poach animals or cut down trees, and you realize that that's going to upset the Kurapira, and guess what? They might be more angry at the people you're guiding, but they're going to come for you as well. Mm-hmm. Or possibly the other side of that is that you are trying to protect the Kurapira, who's sort of a good guy in this version, but the sort of predator-style hunters who've come, either science fiction predators have come to fight them, or the people armed to the teeth looking for exotic cryptid game, and your goal is to stop them before the Kurapira do something even worse to them, or there's collateral damage to the local people as well, because once they go on a rampage, they're somewhat indiscriminate. And then you raise the possibility of this interesting Dominican variant at loose in the urban U.S., which could lead to all sorts of things as it tries to figure out what its role is. Does it become murderously protective of a particular park or a forest near a city? Is it trying to break free of its constraints and pass as human but has to periodically kill someone to protect its secrets? There's all sorts of plot hooks you could develop from that.
And if you're looking for urban adventure, certainly Brazil's got no shortage of those. You could combine it with a gangster or police drama of, you know, the many sorts, Elite Squad or City of God could do stories like that. Only there's also a Kurapira, and the gangsters and the cops maybe have to work together to fight it, or it's a new presence that has emerged in the depths of some favela, and we don't know what it wants, except it does want propitiation. So you need to be bringing some pretty good gold or gems up there to propitiate the Kurapira, or maybe it still wants feathers and you have to figure out how to get them. You know, you're right, involved in bird smuggling suddenly to keep this Kurapira off your back.
Or the beleaguered ordinary people of the favela have brought a bunch of feathers in order to attract a Kirapira who can attack both the corrupt cops on one side and the gangsters on the other side, neither of whom have any regard for human life. So maybe it's time that they learned a lesson monster style.
Exactly.
Well, now that monsters are learning, or perhaps, I guess, more teaching lessons, yeah, it's time for us to not learn any lessons that they want to teach us and instead find an exciting commercial and behind it, another hot Andor segment.
The play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Avert this podcast downfall by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Chuck Cooley,
Oleg,
Chris McLaren,
Darren Dumay,
and Eric R. The groaning of Ken's shelves, the hiding of the receipts, tell us that we're once more checking out Ken's bookshelf, the result of his perfectly legal commercial plundering of an unsuspecting area and its innocent bookstores. In this case, we're looking at just a selection of things that you recently picked up in the Bay Area. There's yet another entire list of things. I've split the list into two, but kept the progression in both cases from militaria to weirdness, rather than just have a whole 15-minute command hut and a whole 15-minute trade crap hut, and then doing the other ones later. So we are going to look at your other half of your haul maybe a bit later, but let's get started with a whole whack of Osprey books. And I guess we should quickly talk about each rather than just doing them as a whack. So yeah, Let's start with Early Roman Armies by Nick Secunda and Simon Northwood.
Yeah, this is armies of Rome from the founding. So basically when they were fancy Etruscan armies down to the 3rd century BC and the beginnings of what eventually became the Legion, when they were starting to have to fight the Greeks instead of a bunch of local hill people like themselves. It's an area of Roman military that isn't often studied. It was nice to pick it up. And of course, as we teased at the beginning, these are Osprey books. So you've got to catch them all, in my personal opinion.
Right. So next on a list of captured Osprey books is The Roman Army from Hadrian to Constantine by Michael Simpkins.
And this, again, is another Men-at-Arms series book. And this sort of brackets the best-known Roman. We didn't have to go into the legions, the classic Caesar era, because I've already got a bunch of books on these. But this is the late Roman army when it is being reformed around heavy cavalry. And also fighting a whole bunch of civil wars against itself, that it's run out of people it can productively fight, so it does nothing but civil wars. Although the cover is showing it fighting a perfectly harmless German, it looks like, but that's all right. They fought a lot of them too.
Right. Well, we're going to stay in the same locale, but move forward in time to Italian Medieval Armies, 1300 to 1500 by David Nicole.
Yeah, there's another Osprey book that's specifically about the condottieri, who are the mercenaries. These are the medieval armies that the mercenaries would either build up or back up. And this is sort of the notion of, you know, what does feudal chivalry look like in a non-feudal society, because of course the Italian armies are basically, you know, city state armies. They're national armies, just very small ones. And that's an interesting question. And, you know, we know all about the Hundred Years' War, and we don't know an awful lot, or at least I don't know an awful lot about all of the various pre-Sforza, pre-Medici dinkering around in Italy. But there must have been some, because it's a place in medieval Europe, so people were surely slaughtering each other.
Also by David Nicol, The Age of Tamerlane.
Yeah, this is not necessarily just The Age of Tamerlane. This is the whole horse nomad, sort of the last great horse nomad invasion is Tamerlane invading mostly Asia, a little bit of Europe. And these are his armies and the armies that he fought. So again, it's not a thing that you see an awful lot in mainstream military history, which, as I say, because Tamerlane was mostly fighting in Central Asia and a little bit in Turkey and India, European military history can take a sigh of relief and ignore him. But it's still the last great conqueror. So good for you, Tamerlane.
Now something, I guess, sort of starts in the middle of the story. We have Louis XV's Army, Part 5, Colonial and Naval Troops by René Chartrand.
Yeah, this is, once we get into the Age of Enlightenment, and more specifically the Age of Plentiful Miniatures, the Osprey Men-at-Arms series really starts breaking stuff down into subcomponents. And it is at that point that I attempt to exercise some modest degree of self-control. And are they more or less likely to be gameable is a question that I begin to ask myself at that point. And as our beloved sponsors, Nations and Cannons, remind us, the games happen on the fringes of big army combat, not necessarily right in the middle. And so the naval troops and the colonial troops would be the sort of, you six guys, go fight a monster for King Louis. And these would be the guys that would be picked, not the sort of stand up and fight infantrymen.
Jumping ahead in time and into the air, it's Richthofen's Circus, Jagdgeschwader number 1 by Greg Van Wingarden.
Yeah, these are a series called the Aviation Elite Units series, and they're bigger than normal Osprey books. They're 128 pages instead of the normal 64, and they are just, well, I don't know. At some point, many, many young lads turn their eyes from dinosaurs to World War I biplanes, and some of us never got over either of them. And to have a whole series of books on the specific units of these, copiously illustrated with biplanes, both photographed and redrawn by wonderful artists, is, well, let's just say that 11-year-old Ken Height would have loved this book even more, perhaps, than current Ken Height does.
Right. Well, before we start spinning out a dinosaur flying aces game, let's move on to the final Osprey book on this list, Anti-Tank Helicopters by Stephen J. Zaloga and George J. Ballin.
And this is from the what was at that time called the Vanguard series, which was the heavy weapons series. They've refurbished those series. This is from 1986. So it is Anti-Tank Helicopters only for your Twilight 2000 game. If you're doing your Cold War 80s adventures, maybe this is for your 80s Delta Green stuff. You can do these. And this is, you know, the classic Hind, the very early Apaches and anti-tank loaded Hueys. You know, you can just smell the morningness in America as you look through that. And it's wonderful stuff. So,
yeah, that's back when anti-tank helicopters wore leg warmers. So that brings us out of Osprey Town to Florence, A Portrait by Michael Levy.
Yeah, this is, it's not a history of Florence. It's not an artistic history of Florence. It's not even really a vibes book about Florence. It's kind of all of those things in one. I'm going to be going to Florence in September, so I'm picking up one-stop shop books on Florence. This is one of those. I think that it is maybe intended to be a vibes book, but because Florence is Florence, there's an awful lot of other data and other details you have to bring in so that you can appreciate the vibe. And I'm pretty sure that this is what Michael Levy is going to do. Obviously, tons of art, tons of illustrations, discussions of Renaissance history, but also beautiful, beautiful pictures of the Arno, which is what we want in life.
Back to some World War One or and slightly post era, we come to The Splintered Empires, The Eastern Front, 1917 to 21 by Prit Butar.
Yeah, this is the third in a volume of works on the Eastern Front of World War One. which is an interesting front, but I think it only gets really interesting once everything starts falling apart. So this last one is the one that I picked up, and it takes it out to 1921 because it includes the Russo-Polish War. It includes the final wars in Turkey, and begins, does not finish, the Russian Civil War. So the notion being that World War One kind of molds into other different fun wars, and that the, you know, geopolitics are all a game of pickup sticks at this point, anyone's game. And there's a lot of really great military details. There's a lot of great political details. It's ripe for adventuring, and it's a time and a place that gets more and more interesting the more I know about it. I'm specifically most interested in the Ottomans of the three empires involved, but the Bolsheviks collapsing and the Kaiser trying to hold it together are interesting stories in and of themselves.
The most intriguing title on this list for me is America's Kingdom, Mythmaking on the Saudi Oil Frontier by Robert Vitalis.
Now, these are not fun myths, Robin. I have to hasten to say this.
This has no forest woodland protector with magic powers?
No. Very few woodland encounters in Saudi Arabia for one reason or another. Robert Vitalis is a man who is very, very annoyed at the oil company Aramco, which is the old coalition between the Saudi National Oil Company and Standard Oil and the various bits of Standard Oil that formed it. This is about the formation of Aramco and how Aramco was run, which turns out the sort of the myth is, oh, why, we were partners with our good Arab friends and everyone worked together in the spirit of improving the world. And of course, it turns out they were a bunch of jerks who were very, very mean to the locals and were building an extractive petroleum industry, which I suppose it surprises no one over the age of six, but Robert Vitalis is very mad that there continue to be historians of the oil industry that act surprised when they find this stuff out.
Right. Accent on the act.
Right. And as always, I feel that one of the best ways to get a gameable book about a modern topic is to find a angry leftist who has written a book about it, because they will be digging into all the underbelly as excitedly as they can. And underbelly is, you know, where games happen. And so this goes back to, you know, Harry St. John Philby betraying the British by setting up this American oil concession. It talks about these Americans that are doing all this sort of, you know, imperial geology, basically, is how you might put it. The deep politics that was going on in the early fall of Delta Green era. This goes down to the mid 60s. So yeah, it's a lot of really strong stuff if you're doing a game or an adventure set in that venue. And also, interesting, because Saudi Arabia did not drop out of the news, it turns out, after 1960. So, who knew?
Oil, somehow, still an issue today. Yeah. Who'd have thunk it?
Who could have thunk it?
Speaking of underbelly, The Incorruptibles, a true story of kingpins, crime busters, and the birth of the American underworld by Dan Slater.
There's a lot of things that are births of the American underworld, it turns out. Like many Greek gods, it gets born a lot of different times.
Well, it has many underworlds.
This is about a vigilante vice squad that was sent into the Lower East Side in the early 1900s. And the attempt to sort of clear out the undesirable element so that proper New Yorkers could take a breath and not have their horses poisoned, which was among the things that was going on the Lower East Side at the time. And as with many vigilante squads, Robin, early successes turn to general collapse and backbiting and corruption and whatnot. So I don't think I'm spoiling anything to say that the Incorruptibles do not stay incorruptible, but it's a great gangster story and another great gameable environment there in the pre-war Lower East Side of New York City.
And moving the gangland story closer to today is Narcoland, The Mexican Drug Lords and Their Godfathers by Annabel Hernandez.
Yeah, the cartels are also not going to leave the news anytime soon, so it's probably incumbent on me to have some books on them. I don't know anything necessarily about this book, except that it was there. And on the back it says, this updated edition includes a new chapter detailing the arrest of El Chapo Guzman, notorious leader of the Sinaloa cartel. So it's at least as current as it could be when it was written, and will provide useful back information if I ever get around to doing a deep dive on the cartels. And even if I don't, it's well indexed, so that'll help.
Well, speaking of well indexed, our need for commercial is also, I'm looking it up right here in the index, and it says commercial, comma, need for. So let's do that and then come back. So The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Cannon Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KENROBIN.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at Yorktown.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at YourDadWillLoveThis.com. And we're back to the second half of half of Ken's Bay Area Book Haul with Tahoe Beneath the Surface, The Hidden Stories of America's Largest Mountain Lake by Scott Lankford. I like a good lake book.
A good lake book. Well, this is a good lake. Lake Tahoe is a lovely lake, but this is also got a lot of stuff going on around it. And this is the sort of, you know, did you know that the Republican Party was launched in or around Lake Tahoe? I can't believe that. I think probably John Fremont may have discovered it and then got famous. But John Muir was there. Mark Twain was there. It used to be a mafia hangout. This is sort of the secret history of Lake Tahoe, or things you didn't know happened in or around Lake Tahoe. So it's an interesting way to sort of do a core sample of American history. And like most core samples of American history, it turns up interesting stuff and crime and politics. So good to know.
I like this next one because normally the formula is an explanatory subtitle and a intriguing title. And this flips that in that the title makes sense, and I have no idea what the subtitle means. The Acoustic World of Early Modern England, Attending to the O Factor by Bruce R. Smith. What is the O Factor?
The O Factor, and get your minds out of the gutters, beloved Cartast listeners. The O Factor is, what does Shakespeare sound like performed in a big wooden O? Which, except for the Globe Theater now, you don't see him that way, because acoustics are different in a modern theater than they would have been in Shakespeare's theater. And so this guy begins from the acoustics of Shakespeare's theater and then attempts to figure out what the plays would have sounded like, and also, I suppose, what the neighborhood would have sounded like, and what the acoustic world, as he says, of Shakespeare would have been. And this is, I mean, I guess it shouldn't surprise me, but I'm always surprised that 400 years after Shakespeare, we still keep coming up with new things to say about Shakespeare. And Shakespeare and acoustics, not a topic I really would have expected, but excited to see it. And if I can't turn this into weird magic stuff, well, I'm not half the guy I think I am.
Now, here's something that requires essentially no explanation. Star Wars Technical Journal by Shane Johnson.
Yeah, it's in this section because, of course, this is where we discuss the higher arts. And this began as a series of Starlog magazines. And I don't know, maybe people got these off the stands. They were in the early 90s, and then they were collected into this book. People who are thinking of the Star Trek Technical Manual need not worry. This is not a patch on the sort of engineering obsessiveness of that book. This is mostly big line drawings of sand crawlers and TIE fighters and stuff with the occasional thing labeled, but it's a wonderful thing. And it's from 1994. So it only covers the true trilogy. It's a great colorful book and it was dirt cheap. And I want to give a shout out to Recycle Books in San Jose, which is where I bought this. And I believe is a new to this bookshelf program. The rest of the books are from either Recycle or from Moe's Books in Berkeley, which of course is a old standard and much beloved and where most of this stuff came from.
Now, this next one either migrated to a different section of the pile or is weird. So let's find out. The Roman Forts of the Saxon Shore by Stephen Johnson.
This is archaeology, and so this is the only archaeology left in the section after you tranched us, but this is archaeology of the Roman Forts of the Saxon Shore. Once the Germans began crossing the Rhine and going into the Roman Empire, they needed to protect the southern coast of Britain from pirates and raiders, and so they built a series of watchtowers and forts, and then put a guy in charge of what was called the Saxon Shore, the Dux Valorum Britannicum. And one theory is that that was King Arthur's job, was that he used to run those forts, and then as things got worse, you know, went into the middle of the country and fought the Saxons there. But either way, if you're trying to run Pendragon and you don't know about the Roman forts of the Saxon Shore, I feel sorry for you. And so that was enough to get it. But also, it's a really good compendium. It's got everything that we knew at the time, which is 1976, about each of these Roman forts. So I'm sure we've done more research since, but again, Pendragon, you can start from 1976 as well as from anywhere else.
So next we have something that I think you've written about this guy, at least in the Nazi occult. We have Otto Rahn, Grail Hunter, The Secret of the Cathars and the Return of the White Lady by disgraced filmmaker Richard Stanley.
Yeah, Stanley has been living in the sort of Cathar country there in the Pyrenees, south of France, for a great old long time. He's written articles about Otto Rahn and the Cathar Grail for Fortean Times and other people. And I guess the time was right for Inner Traditions to ask him to expand it into a book. And here it is at book length, like Inner Traditions. The back cover is jam-packed with text, and the inside of the book has plenty of white space. But still, you can't beat the price. And with the addition of Mysterious White Lady, you have a new wrinkle in the Otto Rahn Cathar complex that I've got a couple of other books about, including Otto Rahn's book, while I'm bragging already. But this is another good compilation of those things. The people of Inner Traditions believe in lots of attractive photographs and adding a little something something. So I'm pleased to own this. And again, Otto Rahn is one of those, just, he's the type of guy that if he didn't exist, he would have already been made up. But to have a SS guy who's going looking for the Holy Grail, but maybe he's sad about being in the SS. It writes itself, really. He's actually probably not that sad about being in the SS until they murdered him. So that may have made him sad.
That may have changed his mind being murdered.
Yeah.
And we have a delightful bit of novelty cinema horror culture with Ingrid Pitt, Bedside Companion for Ghost Hunters by Ingrid Pitt.
Yeah, this is apparently by Ingrid Pitt. It has a foreword by Uri Geller, so there we are. And this is basically a bunch of various haunt stories rewritten by Ingrid or by Ingrid's people. And I prefer to think of it as Ingrid sitting in her negligee typing on her Olivetti, but you do you. And so it's basically a bunch of ghost legends put together in a perfectly cromulent book. The illustrations are mostly line drawings, but there is a sort of a back section on Ingrid Pitt's favorite ghost movies, and who doesn't love that?
And finally, we have a bit of woo with The Art and Practice of Geomancy, Divination, Magic, and Earth Wisdom of the Renaissance by John Michael Greer.
Yeah, and this is maybe something we should do a whole segment on, but when you and I hear geomancy now, we think of feng shui and ley lines and earth energies and stuff like that. And we think, oh, we've got to, you know, look at where the spirit flow or the ki or the fairies are going. Geomancy also was named for a thing that the Arabs called divination by sand, where you would do a bunch of random dots and then you would arrange the dots to determine evens and odds, and that would give you a pattern similar to the trigrams of the I Ching, and you could generate a whole geomantic reading from these random dots. And the geomantic reading had connections to the zodiac, and it had connections to the planets, and you could read it like a tarot, or you could read it like a different thing. And it's one of the, you know, seven arts forbidden by the church that you're not supposed to do, along with astrology and some other stuff. So it's got a lengthy historical basis, but what happened is once enough people got literate, they stopped doing divination by random dots, and it just sort of fell out. It stopped being a thing in the early modern era, And that was the end of it. It had to be rediscovered by the Golden Dawn. And then the Golden Dawn did what they always did, which was take, you know, 2% of a big magic tradition and say, that's the only 2% that matters. We're moving on. So this is Greer's attempt to sort of go back to that medieval and Renaissance divination art, which, like I said, began as an Arabic divination art, and give it its due. And John Michael Greer is a very reliable magic writer. He is definitely a believer, but he's also, you know, interested in you being able to understand what you're doing and why. So his books are all very clear and straightforward in a way that occultism usually isn't. So I'm happy to own another John Michael Greer, and I'm happy to finally have a book on geomancy, which, again, even if you've encountered it, you've almost certainly only encountered it in the, you know, 12 or however many little, or 16, I think, little bunches of dots that were the 16 versions of things you could predict things with. So I'm super happy to have this, and I've already actually sort of gone through it, and it's it was everything I wanted it to be when I picked it up in the bookstore.
Well, I'm delighted to have finally done a tamed, manageable Ken's Bookshelf. So rather than ruin that with a bunch of additional talk that will increase the runtime of this episode, let's wave goodbye to our beloved listeners, and we'll wave hello to them again a week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pellegrin Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Assure the Curapiro that this podcast is a friend of the forest alongside such backers as
Lee Candolino,
Luke Steyer,
Peter Atkinson,
Dan O'Hanlon,
and Eric Parks.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.